Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517legacy.com/podcast to check out all the podcasts that we have going on there, the podcasts that we are affiliated with. There's a plethora. There is a whole family. There's lots of topics being covered. So if you haven't been over there yet, go over there and see if you can find something else to listen to besides me and Chad, because, you know, 126 episodes in, you know, you might need to mix it up a little bit. Maybe not. Maybe you just love the illustrious tones of me and Chad riffing on Leviticus. It's probably been something you've been dreaming about. But, you know, if not, you can go check out something else over there. Also, guys, as we said, Here We Still Stand sold out. But good news is, we are doing a super legit live stream this year. So we'll have more information about that. I think that you're going to actually be able to pre-register for the live stream. It's not going to cost you anything. It'll be free, but you'll get access codes and stuff like that. You'll need some login information. But we will be streaming all of the main sessions from that. Thanks everyone who registered and, you know, sold that thing out 4 months ahead of time. It's a crazy thing, Chad. It's a weird thing that just a couple years in to doing all this stuff that you're selling out something like Here We Still Stand 4 months early.
It's the place to be.
It's the place to be, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's the place to be in so many different ways. I mean, it's a lot of fantastic presentations, but it's just, you know, it's just one of the things that I love about it is just the chance to be around all the people who are there. You know, yeah. You have some great conversations, make some great friendships, have a chance to talk about what the speakers were talking about, kick back and just enjoy being around people who are thirsty for the same grace that you're thirsty for. It's a rare experience and a really great opportunity.
Yeah. So, you know, if you haven't gone, you hear us talk about it all the time. Hey, tune into the live stream. See if you're gonna get a sample of it. Obviously, not the same as being there, but you'll get a feel for it, and then you'll have an opportunity after that to, you know, come next year. So we want to like have as many of you involved as possible, but just because you're not going to be able to come to Here We Still Stand if you haven't registered yet, you have other opportunities to come hang out and tap into that fellowship if you are in the New Jersey area or in the Hattiesburg, Mississippi area, because we're doing city events in both those areas. Maybe you were thinking you were going to go to Here We Still Stand, you didn't register. Well, you could still make the trip to one of those places and hang out. So August 4th, we're going to be in New Jersey, and September 15th, we're going to be in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, doing events at both those places. You can go to ChristLittleFast.org, go to the city events page, and get all the information. The nice thing about those events is you have no reason to not register, because those things are free. So you can just sign up. All you got to do is sign up. We do want you to sign up so we know how many people to expect, but you can go over there, sign up for nothing, make the trip out, or if you're local, come on over. We'd love to hang out with you. All right, Chad. Leviticus 22 is where we're resting at right now.
Yeah, we won't have to rest there very long. We're going to cover it very quickly. I'll give it 2 minutes, and then we're going to jump into chapter 23, which has a lot of good stuff in it. So we've been talking about the priesthood for the last chapter or two. And this chapter continues that discussion, but there's not a whole lot of material here that we have not covered already. And that's why we're just kind of skate through it on to the next chapter. What the chapter is about, more or less, is that if you're a priest, or if you are just a non-priest, a lay person, and you have an offering that you would like to make, then there are certain kinds of requirements for you, bodily kind of requirements that are necessary to make sure that you don't have, for instance, some kind of bodily ailment or some sort of ritual uncleanness before you enter into the sanctuary. So this is to say it for the 100th time, the sanctuary is God's house. And I don't know about you, but I think all of us are like this. I mean, there's certain rules we have about our house, you know. There's maybe certain kinds of situations we don't want to happen there, or maybe in certain people we don't want to enter into our house. Well, it was, I guess, in some way parallel like that with God. I mean, this was his house. This was his courtyard. and everything there belonged to him. And because he is holy, he expected his house to be treated in a holy way. And there are certain things which are antithetical to holiness, things which are impure or unclean are not the way that he would have them be. So your sacrifices have to be without blemish. You can't have some sort of uncleanness to be a priest and step up to the altar to offer sacrifices, or have a ritual uncleanness as a layperson and go there to offer your sacrifices. So that's what the chapter is more or less about. And we've talked about that more than once. And so rather than going through it again, we'll just kind of leave it there. So the chapter ends up with kind of a section like many of these sections in Leviticus end with a conclusion that's one or two verses, maybe three verses long. So I'll read the conclusion of chapter 22 and then we'll jump to 23. So here's how it ends. So you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. And you shall not profane my holy name, but I will be sanctified among the sons of Israel. I am the Lord who sanctifies you, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. So we have this, you could call it a sort of a Trinitarian repetition at the conclusion of this section on the priesthood, where three times he says, I am the Lord. In Hebrew, it would be, I am Yahweh. So I am Yahweh, I am Yahweh, I am Yahweh. This is his self-identification. This every time he says that name, it's a reminder, not just of who he is, but more importantly, who he is for Israel, because this was the covenant name. This was the special holy name by which God gave his people access to him. So he finishes this section up with a threefold repetition of I am Yahweh, and he identifies himself as the one who brought them out of the land of Egypt to be their God, as well as the one who sanctifies them, who makes them holy. So God, who is holy intrinsically, who is holy essentially, who is holy everlastingly, he is the only one who is like that. But he wants people and things and times and places to share his holiness. And so he loans it out, as it were. He gives it. And his giving of holiness is what we call sanctification. So God is holying or sanctifying the people of Israel, the very ones he brought out of Egypt, in order that he might be their God. It's a good thing to keep in mind, because there's a lot of talk of acting holy and being holy and doing holy things and treating holy things in a holy way. And what is behind all that is not the assumption that holiness can somehow be generated by the people, but rather they are to receive the holiness of God and to act with that gift in a way that is in conformity with it, as well as with the giver. So any talk of sanctification or any talk of holiness or any talk of acting in a holy way always works with that foundational truth that God sanctifies and that we are the ones who are sanctified, and any holy type activity in which we are engaged is always a fruit of the Lord's sanctifying work in our lives. So that's the way that section ends.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that holiness, I mean, we've talked about this before, but so holiness has to do with, you know, proximity. And God tells them here, like, that this is how things will need to be. And I am the one who makes you holy. He also says that don't profane my holy name, that I may be sanctified among the children of Israel, or sanctified among my people. That is to be set apart, right? And so what I think maybe counter to what we typically think, that, well, if you're not holy enough, God might leave, right? But what is actually the truth is that the only way to not be holy is to drive God out. So if you drive God out of, in this case, his house, or if you drive him out from your people, you won't be sanctified, because he's your access to sanctification. So it's not that he leaves because you're unsanctified. If we see God pull back from the children of Israel multiple times, and this is usually has to do with them just not wanting him. I mean, essentially, you know, all the language that we've used over and over again about spiritual adultery and idolatry and all this stuff, all of this like is like God puts up with this for long periods of time before he finally like decides he's just going to take the hint and like, oh, you don't want me around anymore. And so he's like, all right, fine. Like, you don't want me to be your God. And when you don't want him to be your God, that's when you become unsanctified. When he finally leaves. So your sanctification rests on just him being your God. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. We see this probably most graphically in the book of Ezekiel, where because the Israelites have profaned the house of God, and I don't mean that they've just, you know, done a couple of things wrong. It's like they have gone all out to bring in as many idols and to practice as many abominations as they can. It's like they've imported every single religion of their area, every single god, every single image, every single profane practice, and they've brought it all into the temple.
Right.
So it becomes, in a sense, the most profane place in Israel, because you have all of this anti-God, anti-Yahweh activity happening there. And because of that, I mean, it doesn't happen overnight, right? This is a, like you said, this is a long, God puts up with things for a long time. But finally, he does reach a limit, and he leaves. He withdraws from the temple. And the only thing that makes it God's house is the fact that God is there. So if God's not there, it's no longer his house. It's nothing, but it's just, you know, it's ready for the bulldozer, which usually comes in the form of Babylonians or Assyrians. So that's what happens. They profane his name, they profane his residence, and so God finally leaves. And when he leaves, he takes his holiness with him.
Right.
And so the people are no longer sanctified as a result of that.
Right. This isn't just some kind of collection of, you know, moral failings or whatever. It's not really a moral thing. It's an intentional theological rebellion that you have going. That's how this occurs. So this isn't like just like some run of the mill heart idolatry. You know, I mean, like, this is literally, like, what he's talking about is, like, literally, intentionally, on purpose, premeditated, bringing in other gods to worship in place of him. It's because you might have all this fear, like, well, I mean, I don't want to drive God out and then not be sanctified. Well, it's a hard thing to do. I mean, you have to really want to do it. Like, there is no time in Israel's history where they like slip up and then like God left and they're like, oh no, we messed up and God left. No, I mean, like, it is over a period of time, intentional rejection and replacement of God. I mean, it is, it's not accidental. Right? There is that you can't lose God if you didn't want to. And even if you did want to, is you're still going to and have to insist over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. So just so you know, you're saying like your access to your sanctification, man, you have to really want, like, you have to really, 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 really want that to go away.
So like if I'm in a hurry one morning and I skip my morning devotions, God's not going to leave me behind.
That's not it. That's not it. I mean, even if you're like, I think I have this idol of whatever, like family or it's not even like that, man. Again, it'd be like this is like you being like, no, this is my God now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bringing this in. That's how it's gonna be. And
yeah,
and so yeah, I mean, this is a willful, intentional. It's always that way. Rejection of what God has said, not a stumbling to perfectly do all the things He has said, but an outright rejection of everything that He has said, especially, as you were saying, in regards to worship. I mean, so like chapter 22 is about his house and what's going to be in there. This is like the place of worship, right? So especially with the way that you like, the way that you worship him, and essentially you're like, I'm not going to worship you anymore. I'm going to worship these other things. Like, and like I said, not just like, whoops, I think I'm falling into some idolatry here, but willfully, intentionally, unrepentantly, over a period of time, eventually God might give you what you want, which is, I don't really want you as my God.
Yeah, just to illustrate what we're talking about by means of Old Testament history. So the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom split. So Israel split into the Northern and Southern Kingdoms after the death of Solomon. So we're talking about the around, we'll say 900 BC, something like that. And the Northern Kingdom, from its very beginning, was a rebellion against God. They set up two calves to worship in Dan and Bethel. Their kings were not legitimated by God. They practiced all kinds of rank idolatry. And God sent them prophets to call them to repentance. And yet it was not until 722 BC when they were destroyed by the Assyrians. And Southern Kingdom, they went through a whole string of horrible, horrible kings. Almost all of them were bad, with just a couple of exceptions like Josiah and Hezekiah, but most of them actively promoted idolatry. And it wasn't until 586 when God finally sent the Babylonians to destroy them. So God is infinitely patient, but there does come a time when there's this kind of rebellion that we've been talking about, when he withdraws his presence. Now, he withdraws it and then still calls them to repentance, because he does bring them back from exile. He doesn't abandon his people. But he does practice this kind of absence, in the sense that he withdraws his presence from Israel, from the temple, in order that he might drive it home to them just how serious their sin is, and call them back to himself and away from their idolatry.
Yep.
All right, so there's 22. 23, we're entering into new territory here, so to speak. It's a new section. We're done with discussion of the priesthood. And what 23 is all about is what you might call the sacred calendar of the Israelites. Now, we've encountered some of these festivals before. A couple of them, I think, are new to us. But we're going to cover in this chapter, starting out with the Sabbath, which is the foundational holy day for Israel, and then the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, both of which are connected to the other. It really is, you can envision Passover and the Festival of Unleavened Bread as one continuous festival. And then there's the first fruits connected with that, Pentecost, A little festival, like a one-day festival called the Festival of Trumpets or Acclamation. We know it today as Rosh Hashanah or Rosh Hashanah in the Hebrew. That is the head of the year or New Year's. Day of Atonement, which we have talked about extensively, especially in connection with chapter 16 of Leviticus. And the Tabernacles or Booths, as to use the old terminology, is how the chapter ends. Now, I'll say by way of preface to this chapter that this is one more area of Israelite lives in which God sanctifies. So we've seen many, many times how God sanctifies people, of course, the people of Israel in particular. He sanctifies the priest in a certain way as well, making them sanctified and holy to offer his gifts. And he also sanctifies places, of course, because we have the tabernacle, and within it, the Holy of Holies and the holy place and the courtyard around it. So we've discussed how the Holy of Holies, because it is the innermost chamber of God, his throne room or his bedroom, however you want to envision that, because that is where he has placed himself in his holiness, then all of the spatial holiness emanates from the Holy of Holies. And so the farther away you are from the Holy of Holies, then the less holy the space is that you're in. And that holiness then ends at the border of Israel. And then it comes right back to the center to the Holy of Holies. So we've talked about holy people and holy space. But this chapter is all about a different kind of holiness, and that is holy time. So just like God chooses some places to be holy and some people to be holy, so he also chooses some times to be holy. And these are called, in this chapter, they're called the appointed times. The Hebrew word behind that appointed is also the root that's used for meeting, like the tent of meeting, the appointed place, if you will. So just like God has his appointed place, his tabernacle, so he has his appointed times. And just like he has that center of holiness, the Holy of Holies, so you can say that we have a center of holy time. You can think of this particular time as sort of the Holy of Holies from which emanates out the other sacred times, and that this timed Holy of Holies is the Sabbath. The Sabbath is, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, the Sabbath is the foundational holy time for Israel. And of course, it occurs every week. It harkens back both to creation, because God rested on the seventh day, but the Sabbath also harkens back to the rest that God gave to Israel by bringing them out of slavery in Egypt. So in Exodus 20, when the Ten Commandments are discussed, the Sabbath is connected with creation, God resting on the seventh day. But in Deuteronomy 5, when the Ten Commandments are given again, when they are remembered and recited, the Sabbath there is connected with the Lord's redemption of his people from Israel. So you got Sabbath connected with creation and Sabbath connected with redemption, both of those. So the Sabbath becomes, the seventh day becomes the Holy of Holies of sacred time. And all the other holy days, whether they're single days or festivals, all the other holy days are in one way or another related to the Sabbath day, related to the seventh day. And we see that in some of their names. We also see that in the occurrence of seven. So Pentecost, for instance, is the day after a seven period, after a 7 week period. So you have seven sevens, 7 days of 7 weeks, 49, of course, followed by the day after that, the 50th day being Pentecost. So a lot of these festivals, just in the number in which they fall, are connected with the Sabbath day. So that's the way this starts out. You have verse 3, for 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there's a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It's a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwellings. So this is a time, the Sabbath day, and all these other times are God's way of saying to the Israelites, listen, I know you got lots of work to do. You're farmers or you're shepherds or you're artisans or whatever it is you're doing. You've got plenty of work to do. You've got this labor in which you're engaged to take care of yourself and your family and your neighbors and the poor people who are in your land. So there's plenty of work to do. There's plenty of times in which you are going to be actively engaged in work for yourself, for your family, for others. But God says, what I'm going to do is I'm going to set aside certain days and certain weeks in which you're not going to work. You're going to take a break. You're going to step back from your labor, and instead you're going to let me labor. I'm going to be doing the work, and you're going to be doing the resting. So this is God's chance, not just to kind of let his people take it easy, but more importantly, this is his chance to step up and say, all right, this time is sacred because in it, I'm going to be doing the work. I'm going to be making atonement for you. I'm going to be giving blessings to you. I'm going to be drawing you into my presence in order that I might sanctify you and give you peace and assurance that I am your God and you are my people. So rather than being burdens these festivals and holy days are divinely designed to be the period in which God can do good things for his people while they rest. So they rest, he works, he gives, and they receive during all these sacred times. So that, by way of kind of preamble, that's what this is all about. God designs the life of Israel so that there's this harmony, this back and forth between working and resting, the focus upon them actively engaged in their vocations and the focus upon God actively engaged in caring for them.
I think it's interesting that that God knows that we won't rest unless we're made to. I mean, so like, I mean, that's what you see in the Sabbath is that, I mean, what's the point here, really? It's not as, I mean, they turn it into this very burdensome thing, but it's not meant to be that way. It's supposed to be this sort of gift to you. But
Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, right? Exactly.
But at the same time, like why does God have to make, like, I mean, this isn't the Ten Commandments. Right? I'd be like, why? Is it really just all about, like, I need a day? You need to give me a day. No, I mean, all days belong to God. I mean, they're all, like, the rising and the setting of the sun. I mean, every day is his. The reason he has to do it is because you won't rest unless you're made to rest. It reminds me of Psalm, like part of Psalm 23 where it says, "You make me lie down in green pastures." That's not him asking you to. You are being made to lie down, because that's how we are. Like, we won't lie down in green pastures unless we're made to, and we won't rest. We won't not work. We will not stop and just be still and know that he is God unless we're made to.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, that is human nature, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, striving, working, always out to achieve this or to accomplish that, to win this or to earn this, whatever it might be. And so God steps in and he says, I'm going to make you lie down.
Yeah, you lie down in this green pasture. I'm going to take your knees out and you're going to lie down. Like, you're going to be still and know that I'm God. You're going to have, it's so funny, man. I mean, like, the Sabbath is like, the command is do nothing, right? And the Pharisees, what they do with this is they just focus on the word do.
Yeah, they come up with 1,000 laws regarding, like, what you can and can't do.
Like, you hear the words do nothing and they're like, well, what does that mean? Like, what are all the things that we shouldn't do? And it's like, man, don't overthink it. Just do nothing. It's just like, it's supposed to be rest. Like, you're, and they just, they instead, they miss the complete heart of the law, and they try to, like, figure out the letter, and they just obsess over this do. Like, what are we not to do? Like, they hear the prohibition in it. They hear this do nothing, and then they try to figure out what something is, and then make sure they don't do it.
It's a great illustration of human nature, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're able to take any gift of God and transform it into a burden, which is what the Jews did at the time of with the Sabbath at the time of Christ. I think I've mentioned before how I took a class on the Sabbath when I was at Hebrew Union College years ago, and you know, you read the New Testament, you read about all these interactions that Jesus has with the Pharisees about Sabbath laws and all of that. And when I took this class, I realized, well, I mean, I knew all of that was true, but what this class did was just confirm it for me, because we read all this Jewish material from that was almost contemporaneous with the New Testament. And yeah, it was just law after law after law. You can walk this many paces from your house. You can't do this in your house. You can't move this to another location in your house. You can't light a fire. You know, today, if you're an Orthodox Jew, you can't flip on a light switch. I mean, it's just, you can't push the buttons on an elevator. I mean, there's just an amazing list of prohibitions that still are active in Judaism today in relationship to what you aren't supposed to do on the Sabbath.
Yeah, because those are all the, that's what they determined the something is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what you've done is you've taken what's supposed to be the best day of the week and made it the worst.
Yeah.
You've taken a day that's supposed to be a day of rest and made it the most burdensome day of the week.
Yeah. I mean, this might be a imperfect analogy, but I think it works. So today is my wife's birthday. So it's a special day for her, right? I mean, this is the day that she gets to be the one who's celebrated. But just imagine if she turned it into a day in which she was constantly asking herself, well, what am I supposed to do on my birthday? You know, what all do I need to be engaged in to make sure that this is a special day for me? Well, it just turns the gift into a work, if that's what our focus is. And the Sabbath is like that. Sabbath is God's gift to us. It's kind of like our birthday. It's a day in which we get to be the one who is served, in which we do nothing but receive the gifts of God. But we find that hard to do because we're takers more easily than we are receivers.
Yeah. Oh,
so that's the Sabbath then becomes kind of the foundation of everything that we're going to see here. And then it starts out with a couple of things that we have already discussed, a couple of holy days. One is the Passover, and then connected with that is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, we've talked about this however many episodes that was ago, back in Exodus, especially with Exodus 12 and 13. The Passover, of course, is a commemoration, annual commemoration of the Lord's redeeming his people from Egypt. But it's more than that. I mean, it's more than a commemoration. It's not like if we commemorate Pearl Harbor, or if we commemorate some positive day. I mean, this is in our national history. Well, this is the 4th of July, for instance. This is our way of remembering what happened way back then. Well, the Passover is in all these festivals are different in one very important respect, because the Israelites never conceived of these festivals as simply commemorations of an event from long ago. They always understood them to be a participation, an ongoing participation in that event. So even in the Passover liturgy, there are lines in which the Israelites, it didn't matter if they were living 20 years or 200 or 2,000 years after the Passover, they identified themselves as being in Egypt at the time of the fathers. So the Lord redeemed us from Pharaoh. The Lord brought us out of the land of Egypt. So what happens in the celebration of the Passover is not a commemoration merely, but a participation in that event by means of the reading of God's word and the consumption of the Passover lamb and everything that's involved in that ceremony. So it didn't matter if it was the Passover or the Festival of Booths or Pentecost or anything else. All these festivals are designed to be kind of above time, in the sense that, yes, they are rooted in history. That was a specific time that God brought Israel out of Egypt. But by participation in the Passover now, we are also connected in a mysterious sort of way, but in a very real sort of way, with the original Passover. So this is God's way of making the Passover ever new and fresh and real for every generation of the Israelites by the annual celebration and participation in the Passover by his people. So this happens in the springtime. On the 14th day of the month is when Passover is celebrated. That's followed on the very next day by the beginning of the festival of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is celebrated for 7 days. And you may remember that the reason unleavened bread is celebrated in connection with the Passover is because the Israelites were so busy getting out of Dodge, getting out of Egypt, that they didn't have time to let the bread that they had gotten together to leaven. So they left with unleavened bread. And so the festival of unleavened bread is a remembrance and a participation in that historic event. So those two are connected one with the other, and they take place in the spring. Right, sort of in connection with them, it's just a day or a couple of days after that, You have what's called, and this comes up in verse 9 and following, you have the festival of first fruits. Really should be called, it's not first fruit so much as first grains, because the fruit was harvested in the fall. So this is the festival in which the farmers would take some of the grain crop and bring it to the tabernacle and give it as a gift to God. So you can envision God is the owner of the Holy Land, and his Israelites are like tenants on that land. So this is like their rent, if you will, that they pay to God. This is their giving back to him, really, what he has first given to them from the produce of the land. So they don't eat of the grain until they have first offered some back to God. And so that takes place just a day or two after Passover and the festival of unleavened bread. So these are all kind of celebrated together in the springtime. Then you wait a few weeks. So you've got Passover, unleavened bread, this bringing of the crop to the first fruits of the crop to God. All this takes place. And then after this, there's a period of 7 weeks and then one more day, which I was just describing earlier. And this is the period between Passover and what we call Pentecost. Now, if you read through Leviticus 23, you're not going to see the word Pentecost appear there. I'm looking in my Bible right now, and that's what this section is called. But the word itself does not occur in the biblical text. In fact, the word is formed from the Greek, so it's not going to appear anywhere in the Old Testament. It's called the Festival of Weeks or Shavuot, which is the Hebrew word for that. So you count 7 weeks after Passover, and then one more day to the 50th day, and that's when Pentecost is celebrated. Now, Pentecost is fascinating for a number of reasons. If you look at most of the Old Testament festival, Pentecost was celebrated as an agricultural festival. So it was a time when you brought in the wheat harvest as a gift to the Lord. So the springtime is when all the grain is being harvested, the barley first and the wheat afterward. So Pentecost was a big celebration of God's giving of produce to the Israelites. They would bring in the crop of grain. They would bring also sacrifices, 7 lambs and a bull and 2 rams. These were burnt offerings. There were sin offerings. There were peace offerings. So this was a celebration of God's blessing to the land. But what happened over time is that Pentecost came to be connected with the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Now, if you were to count up the time when the Israelites left Egypt and the month in which they arrived at Sinai, it pretty much coincides when Pentecost would have been celebrated. And so by the time you get to the New Testament, Pentecost wasn't so much, it was an agricultural festival, but more than that, it was a legal festival. That is, the Israelites celebrated God's giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Now, the reason that's significant is because when you get into Acts chapter 2 and you see what happened at what we sometimes call the first Christian Pentecost, is that we have a complete reversal of that, a fulfillment, if you will, and a reversal, because we no longer celebrate the giving of the law, but instead Pentecost is all about the giving of the Spirit or the giving of grace, the giving of the good news that the Spirit uses to bring all nations into a covenant with the God of Israel. So Pentecost changes over time, and God uses that change in the meaning of the celebration at the time of the New Testament to focus upon his gift of the Spirit, his gift of the good news of the forgiveness of sins that we have in the Messiah.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool that this turns into the celebration of the giving of the law, which of course was the giving of the law to the Jewish people, to Hebrews in their language. But on Pentecost, as we know it, the gospel, the forgiveness of all the sins that the law exposes, is not just proclaimed in, you know, Hebrew or Aramaic or something like that, but that the whole point of the speaking in tongues is that what was given in Hebrew to the Hebrews to reveal sin, the gospel is preached in every tongue. Like all things, it's a greater. It just dwarfs what was done before, right? It dwarfs it in every way. It dwarfs it in the amount of languages that it's proclaimed in. It dwarfs it in the, yes, this thing was given and it has exposed you for a sinner, but here is a greater message that is the what Christ has done and the forgiveness of all sins. So, yeah, so Pentecost is actually pretty rad. I mean, we won't get into this, but there's actually like a Tower of Babel reversal thing going on. I mean, like Pentecost is a great reversal of all kinds of different things that happened in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and anyways, it is the festival that you want to point to kind of pull together lots of different Old Testament stories and see how they found their fulfillment and the fullness in the Messiah's work, and then how that flows out from him into the life of the church today. But I guess we're gonna have to save that for next time because I think.
We are out of time. That's it. I guess next week it's going to be Feasting on Trumpets and a Day of Atonement.
That's it.
Yeah, Feast of Booths, all that stuff. So we didn't get through all the feasts, didn't get through all the days. That's all right. We'll tackle it next time. Guys, if you want to come hang out with us at an event because you missed out on the Here We Still Stand registration, come hang out. New Jersey, Hattiesburg, go over to ChristHoldFast.org, get the information. Either way, Chad, I'm going to hang out with you next week.
Can't wait. See you then.